So today's talk is called Ratnasambhava and the Path of Beauty. Yesterday was devoted to Akshobhya, the Buddha of the East, and his quality of integration, mindfulness, awareness. So what comes next? And we're going to move around from the eastern side of the mandala to the south, which is the realm of the Buddha Ratnasambhava, the jewel born. And it's lovely having the yellow sun of Ratnasambhava coming in through the window and the sparkling jewels of his realm being produced by the bright winter sunshine. And Buddha, as you know, I'm sure, the word Buddha means awakened one, somebody who's completely woken up, in other words. And I'm finding on a retreat like this that sleep and waking are quite a big part of my experience. There are times during meditations when I'm not quite sure whether it's sleep or waking that's happening. And then because I've been sleepy in the meditation, I've sometimes taken a nap in the afternoon. Has anyone else done that? Take a nap after lunch? And then you wake up from your sleep in the afternoon. You're not used to maybe sleeping in the daytime. And you sort of wake up in a slight panic. You know, where am I? What time is it? Oh dear, I'm probably missing something. And you look at your watch and it's all right. Got a bit of space. But you feel rather groggy. And it sort of takes a while to come back to the land of the living. And in the same way, the Buddhist path is made up of this whole sequence, this whole series of waking up experiences, waking up more and more thoroughly, getting used to being a bit more awake than you used to be, which can be quite uncomfortable. At times it's more comfortable to sort of drowse off, isn't it, and pull the duvet over your head. So Akshobhya, the Buddha of the dawn and the growing light, very strongly represents at least the beginning of this process of waking up. It can be rather uncomfortable, but you're rubbing your eyes, you're looking around, you're taking in the day, you're reflecting on where you are now and where you're heading. You're coming fully into the present moment, into the body, with mindfulness, with awareness. You're grounded, you're present. This business of being present is really interesting, isn't it? It's like, you know, you could look back at 2012, the year, which is about to end, and think, was I actually there while it happened? And sometimes it feels a bit like that. It's as if we've missed it. You know, life is happening now. So if you're not here, you'll miss it. It'll pass by. And it passes by quite quickly. And yes, because your mind is planning things, or the thoughts are just taking you away from actually being. There are thoughts that can bring you into being. It's not that thoughts are wrong. So you've opened your eyes. You've started this process of awakening. You've come into the present. You are actually here. You're not missing your life as it's happening. So what's the next step? There's another kind of opening which is needed. Somehow you need to welcome the present moment, not just be in it, but welcome it. Engage with the day. You need to open your heart. And opening the heart is the speciality of Ratnasambhava, the yellow Buddha. He's the Buddha associated with positive emotion. And as we'll see in this talk, he's the Buddha associated with beauty. His route into positive emotion is the path of beauty. So Ratnasambhava is the yellow Buddha of the south. And if you morphed Akshobhya, the blue Buddha, into Ratnasambhava, can you see what would change apart from the colour? What you'd see is his right hand would move. His right hand would move from being like that to being like that. A very subtle but very, very crucial change from facing inwards to facing outwards. From the earth-touching mudra to the mudra, the gesture of generosity, open-handedness. And fitting very well with that mudra is his emblem, his symbol, which he holds in his left hand, and that's a priceless jewel. sometimes said to be the jewel of the bodhicitta, the supreme mind set on enlightenment for the benefit of everybody. So here's a Buddha of abundance, a Buddha of treasures, a Buddha of beauty. He's associated with the middle of the summer and the middle of the day, when the sun is at its brightest and at its warmest. And the sun shines down equally on all people, on all the plants, helping them all to grow and ripen, not picking and choosing, not saying, yeah, shine on you, but not on you. And Ratnasambhava is the colour of ripeness, of rich, ripened grain. He's also associated with the earth element. And the Buddha uses the earth element in one of his similes. He says, in the same way that the rich, absorbent yellow soil doesn't mind whether you're pouring the richest champagne into it or just peeing into it, it absorbs everything alike. It takes it all in. And similarly, the Buddha says, the meditator needs to have this sense of serenity and openness in the face of all experiences, soaking them in as they really are, fully, completely, whether they're pleasant or whether they're unpleasant. So the wisdom of Ratnasambhava is the wisdom of equality, treating everything as enormously valuable, as rich, not picking and choosing according to preferences. And I'll say more about that later. And Ratnasambhava's throne is supported by horses, who represent abundant energy, the energy of positive emotion. He's connected with the human realm, the realm that we all inhabit, the realm where there's a mixture of good and bad, a mixture of pleasant and unpleasant experiences, and where we are, to some extent, objective about our lives. And we're in communication with each other. We're not lost in subjectivity, as one is in the other realms. Now, the weakness of the human realm is pride. And pride is the klesha, the poison associated with Ratnasambhava. And he transforms pride into the wisdom of equality. So Ratnasambhava offers a path of opening the heart. He offers egolessness through the appreciation of beauty. Now, in a way, you could say that each of the, at least the four outer Buddhas, represent a complete path to awakening in himself, an approach that you can take, a speciality that you can have. So Akshobhya's path is the path of ever-growing awareness. Ratnasambhava's path is the path of beauty, melting away the small defensive mind and opening to the riches of reality. And the Red Buddha of the West, Amitabha, offers the path of insight. And Amoghasiddhi, the Green Buddha of the North, the path of beneficial action. The Central Buddha offers a path which is not a path at all. Virochana represents the awakening that's always there, that's always accessible, if only we knew which way to face so that we're actually there with it. However, on this retreat, we're not looking at each Buddha as a separate, complete path to enlightenment that you can choose between so much as one path that's taking us right round the mandala, coming in at the eastern gate of the dawn and now moving round to the midday gate, the yellow gate of Ratnasambhava. The opening heart of beauty and love, or the other positive emotions. So another thing that we've been trying to do on this retreat is to not just stay in the mythical, imaginative realm of the jhanas, but also go back to the historical time of the Buddha himself, the central Buddha, the most important Buddha, Shakyamuni, who founded Buddhism. And I think it is very important to make that connection between the two. They both have their place. They're both very valuable. The mythic and imaginative realm, the realm of visionary experience, the connection with the great teachers of Buddhism and their meditation experiences, and also the memory of the Buddha, the image of the Buddha, the presence almost of the Buddha himself in one's practice, the sense of gratitude to him, but the sense that he was a human being like we are and we can become what he became. So I want to tell you something about how the Buddha taught through beauty and love. And last week we were hearing about the stories that surround the Buddha's enlightenment, the very beginning of his, as it were, career, the time when he first turned the wheel of the Dharma as well. And that's when he started teaching, when he started developing a Sangha, a spiritual community. Now, before very long, in fact, about a year after that event, the Buddha's family, who lived up north in the hills, they heard that their long-lost Prince Siddhartha was still alive. They hadn't had any letters, no phone calls, no texts, no emails, nothing had reached them. But they heard he's still alive, and in fact he'd become a very successful spiritual teacher. And his father, Suddhodana, is described as the Raja of the Buddha's realm, the Shakyan clan. But rather than a king, it seems he was the elected president, elected for a term of about 12 years at a time. But nevertheless, he had definitely decided that his son was going to be groomed to take over, that Siddhartha would be the next president, his successor. So Suddhodana was obviously very keen when he heard that Siddhartha was still alive, that his heir should come back. He needed him, he had a role for him. But the Buddha seemed to be playing a little game with him. And each time a messenger arrived from the Shakyan Republic to wherever the Buddha happened to be at the time, because the Buddha used to tour around, he didn't stay in one place, the messenger simply vanished. And what had happened was that he was so impressed by the Buddha that he'd become one of the Buddha's disciples and completely forgotten about his mission. And nothing got back to Suddhodana, and Suddhodana was getting more and more frustrated about this. Eventually, he specially trained up a new messenger. And this messenger arrived at the Buddha's encampment and said to the Buddha, in the most beautiful, flowery language, "How lovely the Shakyan Republic, the hills. It's springtime. They're so beautiful. Don't you remember them from your boyhood? The flowers are coming out. The trees are green. The hills, imagine the mist on the hills. It's so beautiful. Everything is sparkly and full of life. The snows are melting. The rivers are flowing down from the mountains. Everybody's happy. And the bread is baking. Can't you just smell it, you know?" And then he said, "Please, please, won't you come and visit your dad? He's missing you." And the Buddha agreed. I don't know if it was the bread or, but he agreed. He said, okay, fair enough. So during his stay in Kapilavastu, which was the capital of the Shakyan Republic, the city of his birth, the Buddha met up with most of his friends and his close relatives, and a lot of them decided to become his followers. Often they went forth from the household life and became monks. But there was one man who had no interest at all in such a life, and that man was the Buddha's brother. Now, you may not know that the Buddha had a brother. He wasn't actually a full brother, because the Buddha's mother had died when the Buddha was still a very tiny baby, and she was the only son that she'd had. But the Buddha's mother's sister, the Buddha's aunt, also got married to his father, Suddhodana, became his foster mother, looked after him through his childhood as a baby, suckled him at her own breast, and in a way was his mother. And before long, she had another baby, and this baby was Nanda. So Nanda was sort of more than a half-brother, more than a step-brother, more than a foster brother. He was pretty much almost as close as you can get to being a full brother. In fact, when he grew up, he looked so similar to the Buddha that they were often mistaken for each other. From behind especially, people would say, hello, and they go up to him and discover he turned around and it was Nanda, not the Buddha. But that's going ahead too much. So Nanda was his name, and the two of them had played together as children, and when they were teenagers they learnt the martial arts together. This is one of the things you had to do if you're an aristocrat in the Shakyan Republic, particularly fencing. So Nanda and the Buddha were fencing partners. So while the Buddha was off for some 6 years trying to find the way to Nirvana, Nanda grew up. He grew up into a young man. He grew up into an extraordinarily handsome young man. And he well knew it. He knew how good looking he was. Debonair, beautiful, dark, curling hair, slightly swarthy complexion, tall. And Nanda fell in love. And he fell in love with the most beautiful girl in all the hills. She was known sometimes as Sundari and sometimes as Janapani Kalyani. Janapani Kalyani, which means the beauty of the land. Kalyani means beauty, by the way. It's the same word, Kalyana Mitrata, which you may have come across, the beauty of friendship. So it's the same word that's used for physical beauty, loveliness, gorgeousness. So the two of them, Nanda and Sundari, fell in love with each other very deeply. They were involved in a passionate relationship. Sex before marriage didn't seem to be a particular problem in those days. They were sleeping together. And they vowed to get married as soon as Suddhodana, the Raja, would allow it. Now, the Buddha had come back. Suddhodana, his father, had a good talk with him. And he soon had to accept that the Buddha was going to stay a Buddha. He was not going to come back and take over the presidency of the republic. He just was not in the slightest bit interested in doing that. So the next in line, who's the next in line? The Buddha's younger brother, Nanda. So Suddhodana, okay, Nanda, I better groom him up. He's going to be the new, as it were, Prince of Wales. We'll have the investiture, we'll have the ceremony, consecration ceremony as the heir. And he thought to himself, he can marry Sundari, his girlfriend, as well, can't he? You know, because you need a proper wife if you're going to be the heir to the throne. And I'll give him my summer palace to live in as well. In fact, let's save a little bit of money and we'll have a big party at the same time for all three occasions, for the consecration, for the wedding, and for the housewarming party for the new house. So this was agreed. They're going to have a big party. Now, there's a long and extremely beautiful poem about the love affair between Nanda and Sundari. It really captured the imagination of the early Buddhist poets, in particular Ashvaghosha, the great Sanskrit poet, sometimes regarded as the greatest of all poets in the Sanskrit language, not just in Buddhism, but in other religions as well. But he was a Buddhist. He's most famous for his Life of the Buddha in poetic form. He lived about 1800 or 1900 years ago. And he describes the relationship between Nanda and Sundari in a lot of detail. Now, I'm sure some of this is from his imagination and some of it is from the old texts. And he says that on the night before the wedding, the two of them were sleeping together, although sleeping is not really quite the right word for what they were doing. And as dawn was breaking, Sundari got up and started putting on her makeup. She was a little bit vain. And in those days, both men and women wore makeup. And they were both, could be quite vain, especially aristocrats, beautiful silk clothing. They both wear jewellery and so on. So she looked at Nanda in the light, the dawn light coming through the window. And she said, "You look gorgeous with your morning stubble," she said. She said, "I wish I had stubble," she said. And she took her mascara brush and started painting little black lines on her chin to look like stubble. And she gazed at herself in the mirror. This is all according to Ashvaghosha. I'm not making this up. She gazed at herself in the mirror and smiled. Now, downstairs, the wedding breakfast was being laid out for hundreds of guests. Now, the Buddha did not change his behaviour at all while he was in his father's city. So, as usual in the early morning at this time, he would go from house to house with his bowl, just standing silently outside the back door, collecting any food that was offered for his meal of the day, his one meal of the day. So he turned up at his brother Nanda's house, hoping for a little bit of the wedding breakfast. But nobody noticed him. They were all so busy preparing the wedding, they were so busy looking after Nanda and Sundari and Nanda themselves were so completely caught up in each other that the Buddha stood there for about 10 minutes, nothing happened, so he shrugged his shoulders, walked off to the next house. However, one girl in the household spotted him from an upstairs window as he was leaving, and she burst in on Nanda and Sundari. She said, I'm terribly sorry to interrupt, she said, but your brother, he turned up and nobody noticed him, he's gone off again. And so, of course, Nanda jumped up and said, "Oh dear, you know, that's so rude of me, isn't it? You know, my brother, and I was really hoping he would give a blessing at the marriage as well. So I must go after him. How could I let him go without giving him food?" And Sundari pouted and said, "Oh, I really don't want you to go. I don't. This is such a special day for you and me," she said. You really have to go." And he said, don't worry, I'll be back." He said, "I promise I'll be back before your stubble has dried." Actually, the Chinese version of the story says that as he left, Sundari spat on the floor and said, "You better be back before the spittle is dry, or you are not sharing my bed tonight." Anyway, so Nanda left the house, and he could see the Buddha further on down the road, but he looked back, and Sundari had come out onto the balcony, and she stood there looking down at him with her hair half combed, the Shakyan maid, the fairest in the land, and he felt this enormous longing to go back to her, especially when she said, "Please don't be long, darling husband." Anyway, Nanda caught up the Buddha, his brother, and he said, "I'm really sorry that we missed you, Siddhartha. I mean Bhante. I was a bit busy at the time when you called, but please do come back. You can have some of the wedding breakfast and you can bless the marriage and all that kind of thing." But the Buddha showed him his bowl, which was completely full, and said, "It's okay, I've got plenty of food for today. I don't need to come back. But my bowl's a bit heavy. Do you think you could carry it for me?" "Of course," said Nanda, and they strolled off down the road, the younger brother walking a little bit behind, respectfully, with the bowl, and the Buddha keeping a very mindful silence in front. Now, Nanda was getting more and more agitated. He kept looking back over his shoulder as they moved away from the house. But he already felt in the wrong. He didn't want to interrupt the Buddha's mindful silence. And he kept looking over his shoulder. And eventually they went out through the city gates and they reached the place where the Buddha and his followers were staying, some distance away. And there were several familiar faces there, as you can imagine, including their mutual cousin, Ananda, his brother, Aniruddha, and other members of the, not just the aristocracy, but ordinary people from the Shakyamuni Republic who joined the Buddha's followers. Now, the Buddha had seen how completely obsessed Nanda and Sundari were with each other, and he had a cunning plan. When Nanda was still flustered, the Buddha said to him, "Now look, Nanda, brother, most of your closest friends and relatives, they're here with me. Why don't you stay? Why don't you spend some time as a monk? I can teach you the Dharma. This is an enormously satisfying life. And the ordination is very simple, no problem at all. It won't take long." Now, Nanda was just gobsmacked, I think is the word, like slightly flabbergasted. He had no interest at all in meditation. He had no interest at all in Buddhism. He had respect for his brother, but he'd never even bothered to listen to what on earth it was that Buddhism was supposed to be about. His only interest was Sundari. However, he didn't know what to say, and without really thinking about it, he said, I suppose so. And Ananda took him to one side, cut off all his beautiful hair, gave him a robe to wear, and threw away his clothes, and ordained him as a celibate monk. Now, as I say, Nanda had no interest in meditation, no interest in spiritual life. He tried his best to follow Ananda's instructions, mindfulness of breathing, first stage, count after the out-breath from 1 to 10. All right, after the out-breath, 1 to 10, I'll do my best. But it just didn't work. It did not work at all. All he could think about was Sundari. He was very frank, very open, very charming young man. And he candidly told his fellow monks what was going on. And they called him Sundari Nanda. Sundari's Nanda, in other words, you know, because that's all he could ever think about. That's all he could ever talk about. And the Buddha got to hear about it. Now, by now they'd moved on. As I say, they were always moving. They were down at Shravasti. the great, huge city down to the south. And the Buddha took Nanda to one side and said, "What's going on, Nanda?" And Nanda said, "Well," he said, "Bante, I'm going to give it all up. It's just not working. I can't manage this celibacy business. I must go back to Sundari. I love her. I love her so much. I can't do without her. She is the whole world to me. She's the most beautiful girl in the world. You know that. I can't stop thinking about her. And I just had this image of her looking down from the balcony, her hair half combed. Please don't be long, darling husband. It just goes over and over in my mind." "Hmm," said the Buddha. "So, Sundari is the most beautiful girl in the world, you say?" "Oh yeah, she's absolutely perfect." And then the Buddha did something rather mysterious, and maybe at this point we've left realistic, down-to-earth love story for the mythic realm, I don't know. But what he did was, he gripped Nanda firmly by the elbow and squeezed. And suddenly Nanda felt he was no longer standing on Indian soil. He found himself in paradise, literally in paradise. In fact, it's described to us as the heaven of the 33. And this is the traditional Indian Mount Olympus, where the thunder god and all the other subsidiary Indian deities lived. And also living there are the Apsarasas. I think I pronounced it right, Apsarasas. The heavenly nymphs. And these heavenly nymphs are described as dove-footed. And this doesn't just mean that their feet were very soft. It also means that their feet were a beautiful pinkish colour, like Indian doves. And Nanda could not take his eyes off their feet. I think for the Indians, feet, if you look at an advertising hoarding in ancient India, it would show close-ups of ladies' feet, you know, rather than cleavages. Anyway. So the Buddha looked at Nanda, and he could see he was gazing in awe at the Apsarasas. And in fact, he'd completely fallen out of love with Sundari. You may find this rather reprehensible, this fickleness, but he was a very young man, and he had met something extraordinarily beautiful, namely the Apsarasas. And he said, the Buddha said to him, "Are you still obsessed by Sundari? You still want to see Sundari?" And he said, "Goodness gracious, no," he said. "I mean, compared to these nymphs, she's like a one-eyed monkey." And he remembered the way she'd been painting stubble all over her chin, and he had this sort of feeling, God, that was horrible, wasn't it? Well, the Buddha says, "Which one of those is the prettiest, do you think?" And he spent some time looking at them all. And there were 500 of them, by the way. And he said, "I don't know, I can't decide." He says, "They're all absolutely fabulous." And the Buddha said, "Well, would you like to have one of those Apsarasas as your own the whole time? You know, they don't grow old. You know, they'll stay lovely and beautiful, at least for a whole human lifetime." "Wow, yes," said Nanda. Well, the Buddha says, "I can arrange it." He says, "I can arrange it for you." He said, "But in order to reach the level of the heaven of the 33, you have to perfect your ethical life and cultivate stillness and awareness. Because in Buddhist tradition, the different states of existence all correspond to states of mind," which is very significant, isn't it? "So if you want to get to the heaven of the 33, you have to have a heavenly mind. And that means particularly ethical practice and, to some extent, basic concentration and meditation practice." And the Buddha said, "If you do that, I solemnly promise that you can have the Apsarasas, and they will love you, and they will cherish you, and every pleasure will be yours." "Okay," said Nanda, "when do I start?" And he found himself back on the ground, and immediately he set to meditating and learning all about the precepts. "I undertake the training principle to abstain from harming living beings." And he chanted them, and as hard as he could. So the incentive was pretty strong, and he made a lot of progress. He really did get down to it. Suddenly, the whole spiritual life had become interesting to him. His heart became more open. His mind became stiller. Now, as I said, Nanda was a very frank young man, and he cheerfully told the other monks exactly what he was doing and why he was doing it. And they could not help laughing at him, and they called him the contractor. They said, Nanda the contractor. You're Nanda the contractor. You're not really a monk, he says. There, you're simply working for your promised wages. You're going to be paid wages in apsarasas when you finish the job, haven't you? And Nanda suddenly saw himself. He suddenly saw something of the mirror-like wisdom opening up in his mind. And he saw himself objectively. He saw his obsessiveness. He saw his greediness. He saw his selfishness. And how he identified fully with just gratification of his most immediate needs. Maybe his preparation, the ethics, the meditation had brought him to that much more receptive state. And he said, I'll show them. He said, I'll show them. I'm going to go off on a solitary retreat. And off he went on a solitary retreat, a long solitary retreat. And at the end of it, he gained full awakening, full enlightenment. And he returned and he went to see the Buddha. Oh, hello, Nanda, said the Buddha. Hello, Siddhartha. I mean Bhante. Well, Nanda, I expect you've come for your aspirasas, haven't you? And Nanda said, oh, no, said, I release you fully from your contract. You no longer have to provide me with aspirasas. And he recited a little poem, and this is the poem. Through not reflecting rightly, I was attached to outward appearances. Overcome by passionate love, I was restless and fickle. Because of the skillful means devised by the Buddha, the kinsman of the sun, rightly I acted and extracted my mind from the wheel of life. So that was his little poem, his enlightenment poem. So that's the story, or most of it. And it's very interesting the approach the Buddha took here. It's the first example in Buddhism of what was known as skillful means. Kausalya. The Buddha didn't try to disillusion Nanda. He didn't try to tell him he was mistaken in his love and his desire. He simply showed him something even more desirable. He tuned into the same part of Nanda's mind that was already awake, already active. He showed him girls who were more beautiful, even his girlfriend, the most beautiful in the land, as she was. And then Nanda, for himself, without the Buddha's help, found something more beautiful still, the beauty of awakening itself. So he was taken, as it were, up a scale of beauty. This is Ratnasambhava's path of beauty. Incidentally, the word for beauty, as I say, is Kalyana. Kalyana, lovely word. Kalyana Mitrata. And we call something beautiful when it gives us the kind of pleasure that takes us out of ourselves. I think that's what beauty really means. It takes us out of our inward-looking tendencies. So Sundari was beautiful for Nanda, and she took him out of himself, in a sense. She took him out of his own vanity, his own self-obsession. But unfortunately, the two of them together, by twisting their eye beams together, as the English poets call it, they became cocooned in a slightly larger ego, a double ego instead of a single one. And they forgot about everything else in their obsession with each other. So what the Buddha did was to show Nanda the heavenly apsarasas, the dove-footed nymphs, and how they are connected with ethical behaviour, how they're connected with higher states of consciousness. And this took him to a more exalted beauty again. But this was still limited. It wasn't an egoless beauty. And then he went further to the non-dual beauty of awakening. You could say the scale is from sensual beauty to artistic or aesthetic beauty. I'm not going to go into this, but it might be worth talking about this in the groups. The heavenly nymphs represent the artistic level, the level of appreciation of beauty that you don't immediately appropriate yourself, or that you can't, in fact, because you have to work to change your mental state. And then, from the experience of paradise, of art, finally you move to non-dual beauty, enlightenment itself. And Chakupala calls this a move from the appropriative mode of functioning to the appreciative mode of functioning. The appreciative mode. Appreciation is one of the most positive functions that one can develop. Ratnasambhava represents the appreciation of everything. And his wisdom is the wisdom of equality, which can use every experience to take you out of yourself into something larger, something broader, something more open. So in that appreciative mode, nothing at all is ugly. Now, the Buddha tried to explain to people what happened to them when they were trapped in what in Zen is called small mind, the highly defensive, the limited sense of me and my needs. And he said that there are three levels of this small mind process, three levels of the self-clinging process. The first one is called mind-making. The second one is called I-making. And the third one is called the conceit that I am. Mind-making is this appropriative mode. It's when we feel that by possessing things we'll become more secure. We'll deal with our feelings of inadequacy, we'll deal with our lack of confidence. Not just material things to possess, but lovers, and even ideas as well. So Nanda thought, Sundari is mine, you're mine, all mine. That's the mind-making process. And the eye-making process is to do with identity, is to do with how you see yourself, seeing yourself in a certain way, telling a certain story about yourself. This is the pride of the human realm, the dark side of self-awareness. The characteristic of being a human being is that we've got some self-knowledge, some self-awareness. We can objectively reflect on our own lives, look back at ourselves. But the other side of that self-awareness is this pride of the constant eye-making process, sort of rotating over and over in our mind all the time. And it's so important to us. It leads to an obsession with who we are, with how we appear to others, with the story we want to tell. You remember that theme from yesterday's talk by Vasantra on Akshobhya, the story that we are telling ourselves all the time. And this is the eye-making process. This is the process of identity. And then the most subtle of all in the self-clinging process is the I am conceit. It's simply the sense that we exist as an inner part of experience, separate from the outer world. It's just basic duality itself, the very fact of believing in subjectivity. And this duality is only overcome on the very threshold of enlightenment. However, the obsessive business of mind-making and eye-making, they can be tackled by all of us right away. The I-am conceit, you're very unlikely to lose for a while, but mind-making and eye-making can be tackled now. And we can do this by cultivating something, at least, of the wisdom of equality, Ratnasambhava's wisdom. And I want to read you some verses by Shantideva. And these are from his work, called here A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, or more literally, How to Lead a Bodhi Life. How to Lead a Bodhi Life. A Manual for Bodhisattvas. And this is from the Padmakara Translation Group's translation of it. So this is what Shantideva says. And remember, we're talking here about this process of using the wisdom of equality to produce an equalization of self and other. Strive at first to meditate upon the sameness of yourself and others. In joy and sorrow, all are equal. Thus, be guardian of all, as of yourself. The hand and the other limbs are many and distinct, but all are one, one body, to be kept and guarded. So this is a very important metaphor of Shantideva. It's as if we don't neglect our feet because they're not our hands. Our hands look after our feet. Our feet will carry our hands to the tea counter and get a cup of tea. They don't think, oh no, I'm not going to help the hands, they're not me. So he's saying, just in the same way, we are all members of one body. Humanity is one body, as if we are limbs, as if we are limbs on one body, like the arms of Avalokiteshvara. so one body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are, like me, all one in wanting happiness. And therefore I'll dispel the pain of others, for it's simply pain, just like my own. And others I will aid and benefit, for they are living beings, just like me. Since I and other beings both in wanting happiness are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should strive to have my bliss alone? Since I and others both in fleeing suffering are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should save myself and not the other? And then Shantideva goes on to give various arguments as to why it's just as important to care for others as it is to care for ourselves. The equalization of self and other. A meditation on Ratnasambhava's wisdom. And he goes on, because of strong habituation, I recognize and claim this body as my I. Why then not identify another's body, calling it my I, and vice versa? Why should it be hard to think of this, my body, as another's? So it's a very beautiful and inspiring passage. And it's in the meditation chapter, chapter 8 of the Bodhicaryavatara, if you want to read it. So these are some reflections on how to overcome our tendency to mind-making, the mamankara process it's called, mamankara. Ahankara is eye-making, mamankara is mind-making. But hang on, wait a minute. What about the female Buddha? What's she called? The female Buddha of Ratnasambhava. Mamaki, mamankara, mamaki. It's the same word. It means mindness. The fact of mind is the name of the female Buddha. So she shows how one can identify with everything. You can make everything you own your own in a far more positive way. You can make everything, not just what you own, but you can make others as well. The environment, animals, the trees, you can make it all your own, but not your own in that tight possessive sense, but your own in the sense that you deeply care about it. As if they were all your children. And this deep, profound caring is the caring of positive emotion. And positive emotion is the quality of Ratnasambhava. It's the practice that goes with Ratnasambhava, cultivating positive emotion, and more specifically, the metta bhavana. So we develop in the metta bhavana a sense of really caring about ourselves, but also about others. We see the beauty even in people that we wouldn't normally be attracted to. And I don't know if you've ever done this, opened your eyes during a meditation session and seen somebody's face, and normally you'd think of them as careworn, rather wrinkled, rather asymmetrical. But even if it's a rugged face, even if it's a face that's filled with memories of pain, not conventionally beautiful, you see it more deeply when the person is meditating, if they're reasonably concentrated. You see a shining awareness that you can feel drawn to, a form of higher beauty. You can recognize the beauty of that person. When Nanda was obsessed by Sundari after he left her, the other monks said that he lost his beauty. They said that he had become ugly in his craving. But after his enlightenment, his beauty returned in a new form, and it never left him. His pride had turned into what is called Buddha pride, the confidence of being fully present with everything, caring deeply about everything. Okay, well, I'm going to finish soon, but I just want to finish off by mentioning Sundari. Because what happened to her? We are interested, are we not? Do you remember how we last spotted her? On the balcony, leaning over, looking out at Nanda, with her hair half combed, as he hurried off to meet the Buddha, and she was saying, "Please don't be long, darling husband." Now, the mascara on her face, on her chin, dried, and he didn't come back. In the Chinese version, the spit on the floor dried, and he didn't come back. And she became rather annoyed, and then she became rather worried. And after a while, she became frantic, and she started thinking, you know what it's like? It goes through, and he's gone off with another woman. I'm not good enough for him. Who's he met? There's someone out there, you know. And then, in a way, she was consoled when she heard the truth, when the news came to her that he'd become a celibate monk. But she could not understand it. And she could not stop thinking about him. In a way, they are completely matching people. You know, in fairy tale terms, they are one being in two, really. They both were very beautiful, and they knew how beautiful they were. They were completely obsessed with each other, and nobody else, when they parted company, they couldn't stop thinking about each other. It's as if they were two entangled subatomic particles. And other suitors sought her hand, but she turned them all down, and she just moped. She moped alone in her room. She had no meaning, no purpose for her existence. Now, one day, her mother-in-law came to see her, or her almost mother-in-law. Do you remember who her mother-in-law is? Mahaprajapati, the Buddha's foster mother. Yeah? So she came to see her. Now, what had happened to Mahaprajapati? Mahaprajapati had become ordained as the first Buddhist nun, the very first woman to join the full-time celibate order of bhikkhunis. And she came because she'd heard that Sundari was very unhappy. And she came to see her, and they had a very long talk. Very concerned about Sundari. And the outcome of the talk was that Sundari herself got ordained. Mahaprajapati said, look, we've got a very caring community. We've got, you know, you'll be looked after. You'll find people around you. You won't have all these men chasing you all the time. Because, of course, Sundari was still absolutely gorgeous. Even when she had her hair shaved off, became a nun, she was still absolutely gorgeous. But she only did it because she couldn't think of anything else to do with her life. Now the meaning and love of her life had gone and left her behind. So again, as a mirror image of Nanda, she didn't have any interest in meditation or Buddhism or the spiritual life. And she was still very conscious of her beauty. And she avoided meeting the Buddha because she had the impression that he disparaged any obsession with one's appearance. So she just kept out of his way. She thought he would look down on her. And she was very conscious in that way. The pride of the human realm was very much hers. But one day, she couldn't resist it. She slipped in at the back while the Buddha was giving a talk. And she hoped that he wouldn't notice her. But of course, he did. Yeah. And another very mysterious thing happened. Again, a parallel, this close parallel. Something a bit magical out of this world happened. And everybody present, this wasn't just an experience she was having, everybody present could see, standing beside the Buddha, an extraordinarily beautiful young girl with lovely long hair, wearing jewellery, beautifully made up, flowers behind her ears, a silken sari of many colours, and pink feet. And she was fanning the Buddha with a palm leaf. And Sundari looked at the girl, and she had to admit she was stunningly beautiful. In fact, as she looked more at me, she looked, hang on a minute, she looks just like me. She looks just, except for the hair, of course. And the audience were mesmerized by this girl. In fact, they were not listening to the Buddha at all. They were just gazing at this girl fanning the Buddha. And Sundari was gazing at her as well. But then, and if she was honest, with a slight feeling of satisfaction, she said, oh, hang on a minute, she's got a few grey hairs. And she's got crow's feet around her eyes. She's not as beautiful as I am, she thought. But then, to her horror, Sundari noticed that the girl was visibly ageing during the talk. And over the period of less than an hour, the girl started to droop. Her skin sagged. Her hair started turning white and falling out in clumps. And she trembled. She couldn't hold herself properly. She hadn't the strength to hold the fan anymore. And the audience completely lost interest in her and started paying attention to the Buddha. She became of no interest at all. She was now just an old lady standing there. However, the process hadn't finished. She withered. She shriveled, and she collapsed in a heap on the floor with the sound of two thigh bones hitting each other. And then she became a rotting corpse, and maggots erupted from her eyes and her ears, and her whole body melted, and it became a pool of water on the earth floor, and the earth soaked it all up, and there was nothing left at all, nothing at all. So Sundari had seen her own future. She'd seen herself losing her beauty. She'd seen herself aging and then dying and then vanishing from the face of the earth. And she was extremely sobered by this experience. And she went away and meditated. And then she was profoundly moved by a long talk that the Buddha gave on how one can contemplate the impermanence of one's own body. And she gained enlightenment. Sundari too gained enlightenment. So the pattern was complete of the two mythical halves, Sundari and Nandi. Both were now Buddhas, were enlightened. She hadn't, however, followed the same path as Nanda. She hadn't followed the path of beauty that Nanda had been offered. She was able to take rather stronger medicine. She was able to listen to the path offered by the red Buddha, Amitabha, the need for the small mind to die, spiritual death, so that one can move into a new way of being, the spiritual rebirth of Amoghasiddhi. And those are the themes for tomorrow and the day after. So I'm going to finish there, but I have got some suggested questions for the groups. So remember at the beginning I talked about Akshobhya, the path of awareness, and how Ratnasambhava is the path of beauty. So you might want to consider which is your preferred path, the path of awareness or the path of beauty, or perhaps both. And then I mentioned all the associations with Ratnasambhava, the horses, the colour, the direction, the time of day, the jewel, the giving mudra, generosity. You can see how that all fits in. So how do you respond to those? And then what about the story of Nanda and Sundari? How do you respond to romantic love? How do you respond to sexual desire? Is that something that needs to be given up completely, as Nanda did? Or can you still climb up the scale of beauty while giving sex and love a place in your life? And then how can you move from the appropriative mode of functioning to the appreciative mode? And finally, how can you practice the equalization of self and other in the way that Shantideva described in the poem? Okay, thank you very much. So tea break now, and then we'll go straight off to the groups. Mm-hmm.